This is the third day of this October 2010 7-day session. We'll resume reading from the teachings of 14th century Japanese Zen master Basui from a book titled Mud and Water. He's taking questions here where we left off. And the questioner, this new questioner, says, if one who sees into his inherent nature immediately attains Buddhahood, well, that's what it means. And seeing into one's inherent nature is attaining Buddhahood. Would he possess the six supernatural powers enjoyed by Buddhas? Basui, seeing into one's inherent nature is possession of the six supernatural powers. Questioner, seeing into one's inherent nature is one of the six supernatural powers. How can you say it's all six? Basui, Buddha nature is, from the outset, master of the six sense organs. To keep the master pure and not to be stained by the six dust-producing senses is called the supernatural powers of the Buddha. You know, since this thing about the six senses and the six gates and all comes up repeatedly in Buddhist texts, I'll just say a few words about it. In Buddhism, in addition to the five, what we in the West think of as the five senses, there's also a sixth, which is thinking. And these are considered the six gates or the six doors to the mind. We receive all of our perceptions and impressions and all through these six gates. But the ordinary person does not perceive, does not hear, see, smell, taste, touch, or feel, or think in a pure way, but rather these things are shrouded in the dusts of thought. So when we hear the sound of the train going by, for example, most people don't simply, purely hear that sound. Well, you say, well, what do they? When you're listening, when you hear it, what's going on? Well, what's going on is usually a whole barrage of thoughts that stems from the sound. There's the sound, but then unbeknownst to most people, that immediate clear sound is dusted by all kinds of thoughts associated with the sound. So it is one of the functions of clear perception to just be able to perceive things and to think without the overlay of thoughts. So again, he says, Basui says, to keep the master pure, that is our true mind, and not to be stained by the six dust-producing senses is called the supernatural powers of the Buddha. Questioner, that's not what I heard. As I understand it, the six supernatural powers are clairvoyance, clairaudience, mind reading, knowing past lives, the power to fly through the air, and the power to stop deluded thoughts. How can one attain the six supernatural powers through this one attribute, that is the realizing one's inherent nature? And then Basui, why should this limitless wonder of our inherent nature be nothing more than the six supernatural powers? This infinite light shines of its own accord and watches over all. It is nothingness. It is a wonder. It is silent. It illumines. Though forms can be seen, one is not deluded by them. This is true clairvoyance. Well, clairvoyance, in the conventional sense, means to be able to perceive or know things that are beyond the range of normal human perception. We often refer to clairvoyance instead as psychics. And then there's clairaudience. I actually looked this up in the dictionary to get clearer on what it meant, but there is no entry. It seems to mean and specifically the sound, to be able to hear things. It's clairvoyance through sound, in terms of sound. And he says, Buddha nature is pure and unstained. When sounds are heard through the ears, the echo of vibrations is clearly discerned, and yet there is no dependence on discriminating thoughts. This is true clairaudience. The next one is the power of mind reading. When you clearly understand the nature of your own mind, you will realize the oneness of the minds of the Buddhas of the three worlds, the patriarchs and ordinary people of this world, and various heavenly beings of other worlds. This is the power of mind reading. A little bit more about this. This is something that I guess beginners sometimes imagine, that a Zen teacher can read their minds. I think sometimes it's the same with psychotherapists. They think that psychotherapists can read their minds. Certainly in terms of specific thoughts, this Zen teacher doesn't read minds, but there's no need to. As Basui says, is when you clearly understand the nature of your own mind, you realize, now to paraphrase, you realize mind in general. You know the nature of mind, all minds. And when one is free, when one's own mind is unclouded by thoughts, then it's more of an intuitive understanding of people and not their specific thoughts at any given moment. Of course, there is so much that people reveal through posture, by the way they walk, and just by other less tangible things, just people's energy fields. Anyone with long practice becomes more intuitive and picks up on people's energy fields. It's, I think, the big difference, and I've read this too, the big difference between people we call psychics and ordinary people is that psychics, those impressions, those intuitive impressions that to a great extent everyone is capable of perceiving, the psychic registers them. The psychic acknowledges them or trusts them. But probably everyone has that the potential to have this kind of intuition or sensitivity that goes beyond ordinary sense data. And the next one is the power of knowing past lives. From the moment you realize your inherent nature, your mind will penetrate through eons of emptiness that preceded creation through to the endless future. Clear and independent, it will not attach itself to the changing phenomena of life and death, past and future, but will remain constant without any obstructing doubts. This is the true power of knowing past lives. The next one is the power to fly through the air. When you understand the nature of your own mind, it will thoroughly light up the dark cave of ignorance, and the original natural beauty will be manifest. In an instant, you will pass through the 10 directions without stopping in the blue sky. This is your inherent nature's true power to fly through the air. And then the last one is the power to stop deluded thoughts. When you understand the nature of your own mind, delusions will change into bodhi, or wisdom. Because bodhi is your original inherent nature, it transcends delusion and enlightenment. You won't exist among saints and sinners and won't be stained by the various phenomena. This is the power to stop deluded thoughts. In other words, seeing that deluded thoughts ultimately themselves are part of this true nature. That there's nothing outside this true mind of ours, this original nature. When we see the true nature of deluded thoughts, then they cease to bother us in the same way. That is, we no longer get snared by these deluded thoughts. And if we're not getting snared by them, then they're really kind of not there. This is what Hakuin meant in when we chant the Hakuin chant, where he said, our thought now being no thought. We don't have to get rid of them. We don't have to stop them. We just have to see through them or detach from them. Then they lose their power over us. But of course, this takes long practice and some degree of awakening to the emptiness of the deluded thoughts. This is the real value of Kensho. Is that it means that we will not be deceived by our minds in the same way again. Or to put it another way, the value of Kensho is that it enables us to practice more effectively for however many lifetimes it takes to reach supreme, perfect Buddhahood. The Kensho gets rid of the stuff that's getting in the way so that we can practice more effectively. It doesn't eliminate thoughts and obstructive habit patterns. It's the ongoing practice that dissolves, little by little dissolves, the obstructive habit forces. Now he takes up a matter of teacher-student affinity. Questioner, within the teachings it is said that it is easy for one to believe if the karmic relationship with the teacher is right, and it is easy to enter if the karmic connection to the way is right. It's easy to believe if the karmic connection with the teacher is right. It's easy to enter meaning break through, discriminating consciousness, if the karmic connection to the way is right. So he's distinguishing between the teacher and the way, or maybe the method. He goes on, the questioner, then no matter how hard I practice, I could not be expected to reach enlightenment if my past karma were not right. Should I first try to practice a way that would set my karma right? Most of you will see the silliness of this question. It's through practice that we expiate obstructive karma and clean up our karma. But Basui answers this way. It is evident that some people have a karmic inclination for the way and others do not. Even if one were to teach the way of heretics, I never really learned what this is. It's an old term for non-Buddhist practitioners. That's how we can, anyway, that's how we can understand it. If one were to teach the way of heretics, the way of evil spirits or of the lesser vehicle, these are all practices that have been rejected since ancient times. Those who have a karmic affinity with a teacher, even in a previous birth, will believe him and call him a great teacher. On the other hand, even if one were a Buddha or a patriarch, those who do not have a karmic affinity with him would neither believe what he says nor want to be near him. They would try to go far from where he dwells and slander him. During the time of the Buddha, there were some who slandered him and became disciples of heretics and demons. To follow either the right path or the path of heretics depends on your karmic inclination. This is something that I only understood after many years of practice, that no matter how bad a teacher is, no matter how how much he violates precepts, and no matter how wanton his behavior, there are students who will stay with him. It's not just a matter of what the teacher does or says or is, but it's the karmic affinity between the teacher and the student that determines whether they stay together. Sometimes even the most outrageous conduct by a teacher will be overlooked by a student. And how do you explain that? Well, they have an enduring karma, a karmic connection that keeps them together. And it's only when that karma has exhausted itself will they part, will the student leave the teacher. And as he says, vice versa, that a teacher can be deeply enlightened and dazzling in every kind of way, but if there's not a karmic connection, then a student will not stay with a teacher. It's wonderful, this law of karma. It takes it out of the realm of morality, simple morality of right and wrong. We don't have to get into questions about what's wrong with you. Are you crazy? What are you staying with that teacher for? And I'm thinking now of the various scandals that continue to erupt in Buddhist sanghas in this country and elsewhere. How can you stay with such a teacher? But they might offer reasons, but this is beyond reason. This is simply either karmic affinity that's still operative or not. And then he says, remember here he said, it is evident that some people have a karmic inclination for the way and others do not. But then, skipping down here, he says, with the true Dharma, however, there is not a single person who hasn't the karmic inclination toward it. Seems to be a contradiction. But he's really speaking from two different levels. On the one hand, you can say that, well, we know that there are people who never find the Dharma, and if they do, they may come to an introductory workshop, and then that's it, and I never see them again. So, but when he says, with the true Dharma, there is not a single person who hasn't the karmic inclination toward it. The true Dharma meaning this teaching of our essential nature. We all are equally endowed with this essential nature. In that sense, there isn't a single one of us who hasn't the karmic inclination toward it. Then it becomes a matter of time. When does that karma ripen? It's when it ripens that one then begins practice. But even before one begins practice, before even one comes into contact with the Dharma, one's inherent Buddhahood is a fact. One's intrinsically enlightened nature. From the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. There's the affinity that he's, the inclination he's talking about. So whether he is a beginner or an older practitioner, layman or monk, it goes without saying that all who believe wholeheartedly will attain Buddhahood. When talking about it, therefore, we call it the right Dharma, the original face of all Buddhas and ordinary people, the master of seeing, hearing, and perceiving, the 84,000 skin pores, the 380 joints, virtually the whole body is the Dharma body. Virtually? Hello? That sounds like a translator's error. Yeah, everything except the fingernails. then he says again, what ordinary person does not have karmic inclination for the way? And then he says, there is no ice or snow apart from water. So that line in the Hakuin chant, like water and ice, without water and ice, outside is no Buddhas, was not something that he came up with, but it preceded him by several centuries at least. There is no ice or snow apart from water. The Buddhahood of ordinary people can be likened to snow and ice melting and becoming water. From the beginning, nothing has ever been lost. If one says he has no karmic inclination toward the right Dharma and first wants to practice a method to make this karmic connection, it is like a wave in the ocean searching for the ocean, saying it has no karmic inclination toward it and hence must seek out a means of making this connection. Isn't it just like Yajnadatta searching for his head on top of his head, thinking he has lost it? This is that story that we find in the Three Pillars of Zen, where some foolish person woke up one day and imagined that he lost his head and went running around frantically looking for it, and finally someone clouted him in the head, and he realized that That was just a delusion. So it is with Buddhas and ordinary people. They are like the water and its waves. Wonderful. Wonderful analogy, isn't it? It's like the water and its waves. There's the both sides of reality. There's the equality side, or the undifferentiated side, and then there's the differentiated side of things. Though they are not separated by as much as the width of a hair, because of the one mistaken notion, I am ordinary, or I'm unenlightened, they think that enlightenment is difficult to realize. Well, this is the fundamental obstruction. This notion we carry that I'm unenlightened and I have to somehow get there to the state of enlightenment. It's that very notion that dissolves with the moment of awakening. And we confirm for ourselves that all beings are equally endowed with this enlightened nature from the very no beginning time. We never acquired it, so we can't lose it. It's our nature. It's our nature. Nothing to do with coming or going, getting or not getting. The nature of a wave is water. How crazy it would be for a wave to think, oh, if only I could become water. But as we all know, this fixed idea can be so believable, and in believing it, we hinder ourselves. He goes on, the way of Zen began without the establishment of any sect. It is simply a religion which points to the one original mind of all Buddhas and ordinary people. This mind is nothing other than Buddha nature. To see this nature is what is meant by religious practice. When you realize your Buddha nature, wrong relationships will instantly disappear. Words will be of no concern. The dust of the Dharma will not stain you. The dust of the Dharma would mean ideas about Zen or Buddhism or the Way or the Tao or the Dharma. This is what is called Zen. Attaining Zen is becoming a Buddha. This real Buddha is none other than the heart of all beings, the master of seeing, hearing, and perceiving. Even to call, here he or the translator is calling Zen a religion. But the real essence of Zen is beyond any institution. It's even beyond a method. Zen is not just a method. It is that, but it's so much more than a method. Ultimately, it's nothing. It's nothing. Rinzai was asked, What is the first principle of the holy teaching? He said, emptiness, nothing holy. That was Bodhidharma. Rinzai said, when hungry I eat, when tired I sleep. Rather than calling Zen a religion, call it just this. 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 Now, the questioner frames his question in terms of demons. This is the 14th century. We can just translate, instead of demons, we can render that as obstructive karma, afflictions, psychological and other afflictions of the mind, things that that bedevil us, our anger, our fears, our anxieties, this is what in the 14th century they called demons. Questioner, it is said that one who practices the way will remove obstructing demons. If one simply practices Zazen and doesn't chant sacred words from sutras, okay, let's just simplify that. If one simply practices Zazen and doesn't chant, by what grace will he remove these obstructions? Basui, a robber does not break into the home of a poor child. The cave of demons and heretics, on the other hand, is rich with human egos and analytical thoughts. Clearly seeing into one's nature is called practice, and the seat that puts an end to analytical thoughts is called Zazen. Notice the distinction there. Practice covers much more than Zazen. This is another fixed notion that it takes a while for most of us to get rid of, is the idea of practice as just sitting. Sitting is one aspect of practice, and then there's all the other aspects of it throughout our waking hours. When analytical thoughts are forgotten, views based on knowledge are also forgotten, leaving no trace of ego. The path where heavenly beings fulfill their desire to offer flowers no longer exists. This needs an explanation for some of you. This is a famous story. From the 7th century, a monk by the name of Gozu, that's his Japanese name anyway, was said to have such a deep enlightenment that heavenly beings were said to have offered flowers while he was doing Zazen on the northern cliff of Gozu Mountain. Another version of this is that birds would come and bring him flowers. I guess birds are kind of heavenly beings. But then he met the fourth patriarch, Doshin, and he had one final enlightenment, and then the heavenly beings are said to have stopped coming. Why would they stop coming after that final complete enlightenment? because now there was nothing left of him. No trace of self, even a self that originally attracted these birds or heavenly beings to him. In other words, complete transparency, invisibility in a sense. This is the purity of the state of complete enlightenment. No smell, not even the most wonderful fragrance, just like clear water, crystal, air. So again, the path where heavenly beings fulfill their desire to offer flowers no longer exists. And there is no gate through which demons and heretics can secretly enter. What special incantation can compare with this? Another great Japanese master by the name of Daito Kokushi once said, if you just chant the Daishin, that is it. That's complete. You don't need anything else. Well, that's his view. Basui offers a contrasting view. What special incantation can compare with this? When analytical thoughts are forgotten and views are also forgotten. Then Basui says, it is said in the Prajnaparamita Sutra, quote, on perceiving that the five skandhas are empty, one is saved from all kinds of pain and misfortune. That is why the special incantations cannot be compared with diligent practice of Zazen. Well, luckily, we don't have to choose between them. We do mostly Zazen, and we supplement it with a little chanting each day. Chanting has great power if we do it with a believing heart. That is, if we do it without separation. But if while we're chanting, we're just filing through thoughts in the mind, glancing around the room, checking out other people, then it's just mouthing the words. To do real chanting, what Daito Kokushi meant when he said to do just the Daishin is enough. To do that means to do it in a samadhi, to do it with oneness. So part of our practice is to notice when we're not doing it with oneness, when there is some split. And when we notice that, to just renew our energetic chanting and to close the gap between what's coming out of our mouth and what's going on in the mind, and just really throw ourselves into it. Doesn't mean shouting, doesn't mean especially loud. But what it means is with one's whole mind, one's whole being, one's whole body mind. Whenever we say mind, really, we mean the body as well. It's this mind-body complex. This is why in the instructions and chanting services, we also mention posture, because posture, as in our sitting, our zazen, posture enables us, the correct posture enables us to lose ourselves in the chanting. Lose our thoughts, that means. And now the questioner raises another issue. Even if one practices the way, if he doesn't know how to read one word, surely he will enter the evil path. For example, though he were to attain enlightenment, without wisdom, he could not save people. Here the questioner is falsely making a distinction between enlightenment and wisdom. This is the ambiguity of the word prajna, where it's sometimes, in Zen, it's understood as wisdom, the wisdom that comes from direct experience, and in other schools of Buddhism, it might be considered more knowledge and learning. So he says, if he were to attain enlightenment without wisdom, he could not save people. There are those who say one should practice meditating on mind after studying the sutras. Then there are those who say extensive knowledge and broad studies are the many particles of dust of delusion which form the seeds of interference to enlightenment. Which of these two statements should I believe? Basui, enlightenment is one's inherent nature. This inherent nature is Buddha. Buddha is the way. And the way is wisdom. Everyone possesses this wisdom. It gives each individual perfect harmony. It is the natural beauty of the true ground and original face of all Buddhas and ordinary people. Awakening to this depends only on your aspiration. It makes no difference whether you can read or not. If, for example, one cannot remember his own name, and being a man of inferior roots cannot read at all, if he believes this principle, he is considered a man of superior roots. We're told that the Wei Nung, the sixth patriarch, came to his first awakening when he was illiterate. One who sees into his own nature arouses the great wisdom for which there is no teacher, penetrates the ashes of the Buddhas and the patriarchs, and in an instant realizes the principal Dharma teaching of the 1,000 distinctions and 10,000 divisions, the teachings of the scholars of the 100 houses, that's a Confucian thing, and the causes for birth as humans and gods. What could be hidden from him? Even if, for example, one studies the teachings of the 8 sects, footnote says these are the 8 Japanese sects, and the 3 schools, says Confucianism, Buddhism, and Taoism, or performs wonderful miracles, compared with the original wisdom, it is like a solitary light under the sun. Or, even less, like comparing a firefly to the light of the moon. In Japanese Buddhist temples, a new monk is, I've been told, a new monk is forbidden to read anything except sometimes a sutra, but otherwise not to do any reading. And this is a rule, of course, that we maintain in Sesshin. And then he takes up the case of the great Toksan or Dushan. Just to summarize this, Toksan was a 8th century Chinese scholar who became known far and wide for his mastery of the Diamond Sutra, which is a sutra that's especially venerated in Zen. And he reached a point where he felt he had pretty much exhausted everything in the Diamond Sutra. And then he heard about this school of teaching called Zen, Chan, in the south of China, where the emphasis was entirely on seeing into one's own nature. And he became indignant, as anyone would who had invested so many years in one thing and then hear that it's not necessary. And he went off to denounce them. And on his way to a particular temple, he encountered this woman on the road who was no ordinary woman. And she looked at him with her eyes twinkling and said, What are those books in your backpack?" And Toksan said, "Why, woman, these are my commentaries on the Diamond Sutra." And she said, "Oh, really? Well, let me ask you something. In the Diamond Sutra, I'm familiar with this much. In the Diamond Sutra, it says, past mind is unattainable, present mind is unattainable, future mind is unattainable. With which mind will you..." Oh, I forgot an important part. She gave him some pastries, which in Chinese, the literal translation is mind refreshers. So as he's munching away on these pastries, then she poses this question: with which mind will you eat these pastries? And he was completely stymied. He couldn't answer because she had caught him. There's no past, there's no future, it's not even really present. So which mind will you eat these? And then we pick up, Basui says, "So you see, though this Toksan was a scholar surpassing others, a man so advanced in letters, still, he did not have the power to answer the one question put to him by an old woman selling deep-fried rice cakes by the side of the road. To the contrary, it was the old woman who had the greater power. Nevertheless, because he met a teacher of right views, it was not difficult for him to become enlightened. If understanding the sutras could make enlightenment possible, why hadn't he become enlightened before this? And if writings could save people, why would Toksan have burned the commentaries on the Diamond Sutra?" That was later, where after his enlightenment, where he went out and made a bonfire of all of his commentaries on the Diamond Sutra. And then he takes the other side. Basui takes the other side. He's not going to dismiss the sutras as worthless. "On the other hand, if the uneducated were fit for the Buddha Dharma, wouldn't every farmer in the country realize it? Thus you should realize that awakening to the way depends only on one's aspiration and not on whether or not one is educated. When the aspiring heart is shallow, lack of knowledge becomes an obstacle to the ignorant, and knowledge becomes an obstacle to the educated. But when the aspiring heart is deep, knowledge becomes the basis for understanding the way for the learned, and lack of knowledge becomes the basis for understanding the way for the uneducated. The way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Just abandon everything. Return to yourself and look within. Who is this? Waste no time. Time waits for nobody. Time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.